FlightBridge Ed Live and online courses are even better now that they're powered by iSimulate. With Reality 360 providing powerful monitor and ventilator simulations, students don't have to imagine anymore, they can engage. Now, with the brand new CTGI module, students can train with highly advanced and realistic fetal heart rate simulations. Just another example of FlightBridge Ed and iSimulate being your partner in discovery. Check out iSimulate.com for more information.
What is a lighthouse? It is a tower with a bright light at the top. Located at an important or dangerous place. The main purpose of a lighthouse is to serve as a navigational aid and to warn of dangerous areas. Welcome to the EMS Lighthouse Project Podcast. Illuminating the darkness of current EMS clinical practice with the bright light of science. Here are your hosts, Dr. Jeff Jarvis and Mike Verkest.
Howdy, y'all. This is Dr. Jeff Jarvis. Before we hop into this episode, I owe y'all an apology and an explanation. You might have noticed that there hasn't been an EMS Lighthouse Project podcast in a while. I'm really sorry about that, guys. Our intention is to get one out every other week, but we've had this nasty confluence of issues that has thrown a wrench in the works. Now, I bring this up for four reasons. First off, I'm a whining whiner, and I felt the need to whine, because that's what whining whiners do, and also felt the need to make some excuses. Well, you know, it seems to be the thing to do these days, so I figured I'd hop on the bandwagon. Second, y'all may have heard that the west coast of our country is on fire. Mike lives right outside of Portland, Oregon, and the fires were in his county and threatening his home and his community. He got deployed to the task force that was fighting those fires. Because he was understandably otherwise occupied by these important tasks, he wasn't available to help record or edit the pod. I think we can all understand that, and we wish him, his family, and his entire community well. Stay safe, Mikey. Three, my wife, Christy, and I just moved to a new home. I have a new office complete with, you know, stuff on the walls and plants. I'm sitting here between... well, they're not quite ferns, but at least I'm between two plants. So we left wonderful Salado because I wanted to get closer to work. Same job. I didn't go anywhere. I just have a different home. Okay, last excuse, I swear. This one is actually sort of exciting. Before getting deployed, Mike came up with this great idea that we need to record all of our podcasts with video. Now, I agree that's a great idea, but it turns out I have zero video editing experience. Hell, I only recently figured out how to edit audio with Logic. So I pulled this classic Jeff move, and I jumped right into this with both feet, thinking I knew how to swim. And it turns out it's harder than I thought. Now, I am currently on the really steep end of the learning curve, but I'm getting closer. I'm learning Final Cut Pro slowly but surely. In time, I think we'll be able to have a really nice video show to accompany our audio podcast. In the meantime, I decided for once in my damn life to start slowly. Now, if you're watching this on our FlightBridge Ed YouTube channel, you already know that, well, I'm recording this in both audio and video. This is a pretty straightforward shot here. One camera, one mic, one me. I think I can make this happen. The multi-camera interviews, I have these great plans, but they're just going to have to wait until I learn a bit more. The good news is we have some great topics and interviews lined up to shoot with video. Now, as a bit of a tease, I actually had the exceedingly well-dressed White Tiger himself, Dr. Jason Pickett, over to my EMS office to talk about TXA. That interview was a lot of fun, and I think you're going to like it. It's going to go along with my review of a recent rock paper on TXA for traumatic brain injuries. Y'all may have heard me talk about that in the episode we did about Crash 3. I'm really excited about this. I'm looking forward to figuring out how to make good use of the three camera angles I shot that interview with. All right, enough of the excuses. Let's get down to the meat of this pod, clinical research. If you're keeping up with current events, you've probably heard that more and more states are legalizing the recreational use of marijuana. Now, this comes with an increase in the use of marijuana, and with any drug, there's going to be an increase in the adverse events seen if you have an increase in the use. So one of these adverse effects is this bizarre syndrome that I never heard of in medical school, and I damn sure didn't hear about it in paramedic school. It's called cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome. Now, by now, I suspect a lot of y'all have heard about it. I'm certainly seeing it more and more, and I've been looking for a good paper to use to bring it up on the pod. So let's start off with a case to put it in a nice clinical context. You get a call to a private residence for a 28-year-old male with belly pain. You're led into the living room of a pretty well-kept home, and you find your patient lying in a fetal position on the couch, rocking back and forth, moaning in pain. You see no hazard, so you go ahead, you go in, you make contact with your patient, and your general impression is that he's uncomfortable, but he seems to be breathing well, there's no tachypnea, and there's no use of accessory muscles. You reach down, you feel a bounding, regular radial pulse going around 110, and his skin is wet. I mean, like, really wet. And you look around, and it turns out his clothes are kind of damp, and his hair is a little bit wet. And he tells you he just got out of the shower. Well, that certainly explains the wet part. He's complaining of nausea, vomiting, and this diffuse abdominal pain that he says feels like a cramping. He's had this off and on for the past few months. He's been to multiple emergency departments multiple times and hasn't received a diagnosis. The antiemetic prescriptions that he's been given, primarily on Dancitron, hasn't been helping at all. About the only thing that does help with the nausea is Dilaudid and Phenergan. Now, this might set off a couple of sirens in the back of your head, but when you think about it, he doesn't seem to be asking you to give him Dilaudid or fentanyl or whatever sort of candy you have. And he doesn't really seem like a drug seeker. Just your spidey sense tells you that's not the issue here. Now, there's nothing, he tells you, that makes this pain worse, including movement or eating. He said he has not had any fever or diarrhea. And since you're asking these sorts of questions, he says, no, I haven't had any sick contacts. I haven't been tested for COVID. I haven't been around anyone who's been tested for COVID. Hell, I don't even know what this COVID thing is that you're talking about. Yes, I can smell and taste just fine, thank you. And he hasn't been coughing. So that pain he has, it doesn't really radiate, and it comes on slowly, usually after the nausea and vomiting start. About the only thing that he's found that actually helps is taking hot showers. And when he says hot, he means really hot, like as hot as it will go. And he sits in that shower until the hot water is out. And he does this several times a day because that's the only thing he's found that helps ease these symptoms. Now, the only medication he takes is the prescribed ondansetron. And as a reminder, that's not helping. He doesn't have any drug allergies and he doesn't have any other medical problems. Until about 4 months ago, he was in good health. He says specifically he does not drink alcohol. He does smoke marijuana a little bit, and he's not a diabetic. He says his marijuana habit, he's really only been smoking a couple joints a day for the past few years. Now that you mention it, when he started to get these symptoms, he actually started to start smoking more because he heard that pot helps with nausea. Your assessment shows vital signs of blood pressure of 118 over 84, a heart rate of 114 in regular, respiratory rate of 20, SpO2 of 98% on room air, end-tidal CO2 of 30, temperature is 97.8, a glorious fever-free 97.8. EKG is just a sinus tachycardia. You do a 12 lead just for good measure. You don't see any ST elevation or depression. He's got a normal axis, and there is no ectopy. He's awake, he's alert, doesn't have any disorientation, and there's no apparent focal weakness or neurodeficit. His lungs are clear bilaterally, and despite complaining of diffuse abdominal pain, he doesn't really have any tenderness when you actually press. And specifically, he does not have a Murphy's sign, and he doesn't have tenderness over McBurney's point, something that you might associate with cholecystitis or cholelithiasis or appendicitis. He's not distended. He doesn't have hyperactive bowel sounds like you might see with, say, a small bowel obstruction. There's no rebound and no guarding. And in general, this is a pretty reassuring, benign abdominal exam. You start an IV, you give him a liter of ringers, and you throw in 8 of IV ondansetron just for good measure. The fluids help his heart rate a little bit, drops down into the high 90s, but his symptoms really don't improve. You have a long transport, so after you're not seeing much improvement with the Zofran, you switch over to Reglan. You throw 10 milligrams of metoclopramide into a 100 ml bag and run that in over 10 minutes. Yeah, and that doesn't work either. Then you're sitting there right as you're coming up to the emergency department. You're really scratching your head and you're saying, what the hell is going on here? What could be helping him? Well, it turns out this is a classic case of cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome, or CHS. Now, CHS is an interesting acronym because I went to Cleveland High School. CHS had a different meaning to me. Now, CHS is an odd idiosyncratic reaction to marijuana. I say odd because, as your patient correctly indicated, THC, the active ingredient in marijuana, really is an antiemetic for most people. For some reason, some folks, we don't really know why, but some folks, usually, but not always with chronic daily use of marijuana, can actually develop this uncontrolled nausea, vomiting, and abdominal pain the more they smoke. They will usually go through extensive evaluations, multiple ER visits. They're probably going to get a fairly thorough evaluation by gastroenterology. They may have an unremarkable endoscopy study. I'm sure they'll have an H. pylori test looking for the bacteria that causes most peptic ulcer disease. And they may even have gastric motility. Studies done anyway. And the gastric motility part, that's really important because that helps differentiate CHS from gastroparesis. And gastroparesis presents sort of the same, but it's caused because of a delayed transit through the stomach. Gastroparesis is often seen in diabetics, so it's important to get that little nugget of history right up front. Now, finally, gastroparesis, even though the symptoms are the same, it's not associated with marijuana use, and it isn't helped by hot showers. That hot shower thing is really specific for cannabinoid hyperemesis. Now, the only definitive treatment for CHS is marijuana cessation. And the interesting thing, at least in my experience with these patients, the suggestion that marijuana might be causing their symptoms and that the only way to treat the symptoms is to stop smoking, initially, and by initially, I mean the initial 5 to 10 visits, that's usually met with utter disbelief. There is no way, doc, that these symptoms can be caused from the bong. It's just not possible. We all know marijuana decreases these symptoms. Let's go back to that hot shower thing. Along with marijuana use, taking multiple hot showers a day is almost diagnostic for CHS. We're not really sure what's up with that or why it seems to help, but there are some theories. And one of those is important to this conversation. We think that the hot showers stimulate receptors responsible for detecting heat on the skin. Now, this isn't really important, but these receptors are called TRPV1. And that stands for transient receptor potential vanilloid 1 receptors. There. TRPV1. Make sure you work that little factoid into your next conversation over drinks at the bar. Well, that's assuming we ever get back to actually being able to have conversations over drinks at a bar with our buddy. I hope we do because I'm missing the drinks, I'm missing the bar, and I'm missing y'all. I want to be able to get to see y'all again at some conferences. All right, back to the TRPV. One, how does it help? We have zero clue, but it does seem to help. The reason that's important is that those TRPV1 receptors are also stimulated by capsaicin cream. Yes, that capsaicin. The little burny bits from chili and pepper spray. In low concentrations, topical ointment stimulates a heat sensation without any pain. Now, that's assuming that you keep the burny bits out of your eyes. And this is an important safety tip. I think I want y'all to write this down. You're definitely, definitely going to want to keep that stuff out your eyes. Don't say I didn't warn you. Important safety tip from your friend Jeff. So if hot showers can help these symptoms and capsaicin cream stimulates heat receptor, can maybe topical capsaicin cream help the symptoms too? And that is a great question. I'm really glad you asked. It turns out capsaicin cream is available over the counter in concentrations up to 0.1%. And it's used for pain from osteoarthritis and diabetic neuropathy. So I found a paper that was published in Academic Emergency Medicine earlier this year that looked at whether topical use of this cream might help CHS symptoms. The name of the paper is A Pilot Trial of Topical Capsaicin Cream for the Treatment of Cannabinoid Hyperemesis Syndrome. The lead author is Dr. Diana Dean, and the senior author is Dr. Joseph Miller. The study looks like, it doesn't say this explicitly, but it kind of looks like it was done at a large ER in Detroit. And I'm guessing based on the author affiliations that it was probably Henry Ford. Now, as the title suggests, this was a pilot trial. Pilot trials are by design small and designed to test the feasibility of a larger study, as well as the safety and efficacy, and to get that out there. If the pilot study shows promise, then a larger study can be done that's powered to better detect these differences. So this was a small, randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial done in a single large urban emergency department. The inclusion criteria were adults over 17 years old who had a suspected CHS exacerbation with nausea and vomiting. Now, most of them also had abdominal pain, but that wasn't an inclusion criteria. They were excluded if they were pregnant, if they had an allergy to capsaicin cream, and I'm not sure how they would have figured that out, or if they had an allergy to hot peppers, that I can kind of see how they might have figured out, or if they had gotten any antiemetics in the prior 24 hours. This last exclusion, it had to be dropped about halfway through the study for some interesting reasons. So it turns out they found requiring patients to consent to treatment while they were symptomatic but before giving them any treatment made it really hard to enroll patients. Once they started enrolling patients after they'd been given IV antiemetics, almost always ondansetron, they found more patients consented. Now, I'm actually kind of curious about this. I'm curious how their IRB looked at this question initially and whether they felt like there might be a potential danger of some patients feeling coerced into consent. Now, I'm sure the people doing the enrolling made it really clear treatment was not contingent on enrollment, but I'm just curious about it. Now, I'm not on an IRB, and I don't have any experience trying to make these determinations. I'm always on the other end of the IRB, the one begging and scratching at the door saying, please, please approve my study. So I'm just kind of curious what the decision-making is. Now, patients were identified by the treating ER doc, but they were consented and monitored by research associates who were working in the emergency department. These trained folks were available in the ER between 8 a.m. and midnight, 7 freaking days a week, except, you know, for holidays. It's things like this, and I say this with all sincerity, that make me jealous of academic emergency departments. That's just cool that those folks are available to help out with research. My cat, who's down here thumping away on the furniture, that's Puck, and Puck thinks it's pretty impressive too. He might be a little jealous also. So these research associates would handle the consent, they would do the enrollment, they would do the data collection and reporting, and they'd even stay in the room with the patient for the first 60 minutes of treatment to monitor for any adverse events. So the intervention was topical administration of 5 grams of 0.1% capsaicin cream rubbed with loving care on the abdomen. Now, the control was moisturizing cream that looked kind of like the capsaicin cream, and I'm sure it was also applied with an identical amount of loving care. Neither one of these creams apparently had any sort of odor. They were administered by the ER nurse from unmarked tubes. Patients were randomized to get one of those two tubes on a one-to-one basis, stratified out by sex. Now, the primary outcome was the amount of nausea at 30 minutes as defined using a visual acuity scale or a VAS. And those are similar to the pain scores that we're all painfully familiar with. So some of the secondary outcomes were nausea score at 60 minutes, side effects, and the need for rescue medication. Interestingly, just like with the pain score, there is a validated minimal clinically important reduction in nausea. We know what the amount of reduction you need to be clinically important. And just like with pain, the amount of nausea score or the amount the nausea scores have to decrease to be clinically important is 2.1 on that 0 to 10 scale. And that's good to know. Now, maybe because I've had too many tacos with the good Dr. Crow. Wait, that's not right. Who am I kidding? You can never have too many tacos with Remley. But whatever the reason is, I think she has convinced me that a better way of looking at these continuous variables like pain and, in this case, nausea, is instead of looking at the amount reduced, look at the proportion of patients who achieved a clinically meaningful reduction. Now, unfortunately, they didn't report this. I hope when they do a larger study, they do report it. They did, however, give us the proportion of patients with complete resolution. That's also important, and I like that. So ultimately, they ended up enrolling 30 patients after they screened over 600. Turns out it was pretty hard to find these folks and get them enrolled. For those who are only listening to this podcast, right now I'm putting up figure 1 on the YouTube video. It shows a diagram of patient flow through the study. It shows 17 patients were randomized to the intervention group and 13 to the placebo group. It also shows they happened to screen 581 patients for eligibility who ultimately turned out not to be eligible. The one I was interested in was the 56 of those patients who said, "No way, I'm participating." And most of those were because, and this is not surprising, but it is nice to see it written, they did not think marijuana was causing their symptoms. It's exactly what I found. They just don't believe me when I tell them it's the pot. All right, now I'm going to put up table 1. Table 1 in any paper shows the baseline differences between groups. Overall, it looked to me like the randomization didn't work so well. Now, these are small numbers, so we wouldn't expect it to be as good as it would be with bigger numbers. Overall, the patients that looked like they that got the capsaicin looked older, and they looked more likely to be female, and they had more nausea, meaning higher nausea scores at baseline. Now, with these small numbers, I'm really not sure how significant these differences were. Maybe because they're small, they were more significant. I don't know. One way to look at this is to try to attempt to control for it, like, say, with a regression model. But this was just a pilot study, so they didn't do it. Okay, so overall, what did they find? Puck down there. Puck wants to know what they found, too. They found that despite a trend toward less nausea with capsaicin, no significant difference in nausea scores at 30 minutes existed, but they did find less nausea at 60 minutes. They also found less need for rescue medication at 30 minutes. And incidentally, all of these patients got some sort of IV antiemetic in addition to the capsaicin cream or the placebo. So no difference at 30 minutes, a difference at 60 minutes. The capsaicin cream worked better, and less need for rescue medications in the capsaicin group at 30 minutes. Now, they also found that more patients had complete resolution of symptoms if they got the capsaicin cream compared to placebo. And it wasn't a small difference either. It was 29% in the capsaicin group and 0% in the placebo group. And that was significant. Now, again, this is just a small pilot trial, so it isn't really worth delving too deeply into the numbers. But it looks like a larger study might be able to show more clear evidence of benefit. So while this isn't definitive, these are encouraging results. I know I've had luck with these patients the couple of times I tried the capsaicin cream. To be honest, though, I didn't try it alone. I can't really judge how well the cream worked, because I also simultaneously gave them haloperidol because I wanted to improve their symptoms as rapidly as possible so that they could go home to their nice, comfortable home, unlike my horribly uncomfortable ER. So I don't really know, was it the capsaicin or the haloperidol? As they say, we need more studies to find out. Maybe this study, but on a bigger basis. And it does look like these authors are interested in following up with a larger study, and I really hope they do. I'd like to see what they find. All right, so what's my bottom line? Well, I think these folks are absolutely miserable. I think capsaicin cream seems harmless. And by the way, the side effects were not statistically different. There was one patient who had to have the capsaicin wiped off because it was burning. It is interesting, though, that in the consent process, they had to tell them this stuff may burn. So it might have been planted in their head that it's going to burn. But still, only one of those patients had to have it taken off. So the symptoms are real. They're miserable. The capsaicin cream seems harmless, and it might help. And as an added bonus, it's available over the counter. So I'm going to keep using it in the emergency department. Probably I'll use it more because I'm really interested and I want to see how well this works. And I may even recommend, along with marijuana cessation, that they give this a try at home. Now, let's just say you have a friend who maybe smokes a lot of weed and he seems to have lots of vomiting and maybe even takes a lot of hot showers. You might suggest capsaicin cream and taking a couple steps away from the bong. I am really interested in how many of y'all ended up checking out this video on YouTube. You can find it and lots of other great content on the FlightBridge Ed YouTube channel. I want you to drop me an email at jeff.jarvis@flightbridgeed.com, and that's two E's, one at the end of bridge and one at the beginning of Ed, or you can hit me on Twitter at Dr. Jeff Jarvis. Let me know if you watch the video, if you like the video option, or if you think it's a complete waste of time. I always enjoy hearing from y'all. Please let us know if you have any questions, comments, or even suggestions, and we so love the suggestions for papers you want us to review in the future. As always, please subscribe to the pod in Apple Podcasts, Overcast, or wherever you get your pods, and please give us a nice 5-star rating. Those ratings drive the algorithms that control our lives, and they help suggest us to others who might be interested in the pod. And finally, guys, please join me in wishing safety and comfort to our buddies Mike, Ratu, and all of our other friends on the West Coast during these horrible fires. Take care, y'all, and thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast, a proud member of the FlightBridge Ed podcast family and a Fire Dog production. Visit FlightBridgeEd.com for more information.